Hi there, I'm Jason Gotts, and you're listening to Think Again, a Big Think podcast. Ten 10,000 years or so of human history, and as far as we know, young adulthood hasn't gotten any less weird. My guest today is actress and filmmaker Noelle Wells. She's been a cast member of Saturday Night Live, she played Rachel on the Netflix series Master of None, and she's making her directorial debut with Mr. Roosevelt, a sweet, moving indie comedy that's ostensibly about a dead cat, but that's really about that very awkward, and for some of us, very protracted moment of coming to terms with life as a grown-up. Welcome to Think Again, Noah.
Hi.
Hi.
I loved that intro.
Having told everyone what I think your movie is about, like, what do you think?
I think that's what the movie's about. I have a hard time articulating it. That's why I wrote a movie. If I was able to articulate more succinctly what it feels like to be a person kind of coming to terms with responsibility in adulthood, I would just write an essay. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But to me,
which is why I basically wrote an essay.
Well, you did a great job, and I was very impressed. I'm not succinct with words, and I'm all about, I just have a lot of feelings and I'm always trying to figure out the best way to express them. But yeah, so watch the movie if you get an impression of what I was trying to do. That's hopefully a success.
Yeah. So, okay. I mean, so lots of questions. We don't need like a point by point on sort of like how autobiographical the movie is. It's obviously partly autobiographical, but...
Yeah, but yes.
But we don't need to...
I think it's such an interesting thing. I just wrote from sort of experiences that I've had, but to me it was more important to write an entertaining film.
Maybe you could like briefly summarize the story of the film for people who haven't...
It's about a struggling comedian who had moved out to LA to pursue her career, but she doesn't quite know what she's doing or what she really wants to say. She has to go back to her college town of Austin because her cat gets sick, and when she arrives there, she finds out that her ex-boyfriend, who she left the cat with, is now living and dating with a new girlfriend, and she has everything together. She's an amazing person. She's an Instagram persona, if that makes any sense. And so there's just a battle ensues between, you know, ownership of the cat, and Emily sort of has to come to terms with the people that she left behind. Yeah. See, I'm not even good about summarizing my own movie.
I think it's great. And indeed, I think one of the most effective moments in the movie, which I won't like give away in too much detail, but is that moment when Emily and her ex-boyfriend are very drunk and coming. They've sort of had a kind of illicit reconciliation and are just dealing with it in the street in a very raw way. That's really, it's a powerful moment.
Yeah, I really like that scene, especially because she has sort of made it in her head that he has been stripped of his personality the whole movie. And she feels like the the new girlfriend has anesthetized him in a lot of ways. He has given up music to become a real estate agent, and she really believes in him and his music. And so them... You know, we get to see sort of some of his old spark come back, and then they have this, they go at it in the street in multiple ways. And it turns out that what she's projecting on what she thinks he should be doing is something that he actually doesn't want to do with his life anymore. And she thinks she knows it all. And he kind of cuts her down to size and is like, you are kind of a terrible person and you're really selfish and you need to grow up. And so, I love that movie, that scene in the movie too.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. And there were other, like, there are a couple moments in the movie. You were talking about how you're not like, you know, you're not primarily trying to communicate always through words, even though there's obviously a script, but that it's not about like wrestling the right words precisely into place. It's more about, you know, conveying feelings and images and moments and so on. And there's like a couple of moments that are really weird and wonderful and abstract. Like the moment when toward the end of the movie where Emily and I forget the name of the friend who kind of
Jen
are like running around on the lawn, and you know, and it's essentially, it's like an abstract playing out of emotion that results in a very important kind of plot point, you know, but it's cool. Like you go to this sort of surreal, almost abstract place. In a way.
I remember, well, a lot of the beats in the movie are sort of absurd. Like nobody should be getting upset over the things that are happening, but.
Like even beginning perhaps with the level of attachment to the cat.
Which people might not understand. So it really is all about the emotions. And so that scene in the yard, I remember, like it was obviously to me, it was like, well, this is one of the most important scenes in the movie and also hopefully one of the funniest because it's so ridiculous. And I had a crew member who was kind of in charge of a lot of things that set be like, but really, why is this happening? Like, nobody would be doing this. And I was like, oh, you don't understand. That's the exact point of us filming this. And he's like, well, she could get away from her. Why is it going, you know, he was like, she could actually just run away. And I was like, because she's so overwhelmed and it's really more about something else. It's like a standoff about something totally different.
I think that and like, you know, there's a scene where like apparently it's legal in Austin to be topless in public swimming place. And this moment where Emily is wrestling with the fact that like all the girls around her are simply taking their tops off and jumping in the water. And she makes the decision to do it herself. And that too is a sort of abstract moment that is like incredibly charged with meaning in terms of this kind of coming to terms with herself that Emily is trying to do.
Yeah, that was also one of the scenes I was really looking forward to filming. I love how it turned out. It didn't turn out exactly what I imagined it as, but it makes me happy to hear that people connect with it because sometimes I'm nervous that it's not working when I watch it with an audience.
No, well, I don't know. I mean, all I know is that like, I just thought it was like really illuminating about Emily's character and what she was going through, just trying to kind of own herself as an adult.
There's like a little bit of, I mean, comedically, personally, I never really did well in improv because I could never come up with the right words to say. But anytime I was doing group improv.
No, wait, I'm sorry, interrupting. You went out to LA like to, were you involved with UCB?
I started doing sketch at UCB. I took improv classes and I was terrible at it. Mostly because I could never find the words, but I always knew what should be happening or I knew how to augment the scene in like a good way. And so usually I would be on the back line and anytime I would interject, it was usually just me doing sound effects or like doing people that aren't saying anything because I couldn't come up with the words, but I knew what I wanted to convey.
Oh, I'm sorry. As you're speaking, I'm thinking also of this moment where the ex-boyfriend is playing his guitar and you're doing this like crazy dance in the background. It's like totally, awesome.
Yeah, so there was a lot of that I tried to pull off in the film. Some of them are more successful than others. It was still an indie film, and we really had little time. That whole party sequence, even with that whole dancing, I did like two takes of it.
Okay.
And so I never...
I know. I understand these days, like, even big budget productions are extremely restricted in time. Yeah. Like, how long did you have to film the whole thing?
The whole movie was 22 days. It was a longer... It was a 108-page script, so we did 22 days, which is actually pretty generous for an indie film, but we were shooting on film, so that sort of slowed us down.
Okay.
But interestingly, we ended up shooting like a pretty good ratio, even on film.
I'm sorry, for people who don't have any idea what that means, like on film as opposed to digital slows you down because?
Because we're shooting on 16mm, there's less film on a mag, and so you have to swap out your mags all the time. So I think there's 11 minutes on a 16mm or something like that.
Okay.
And so you can only shoot 11 minutes of footage before you have to stop, take it off, reel up another thing, put it on.
And
when you start filming, you'll shoot like 9 minutes on a mag, and then you start shooting another scene, but you only have 2 minutes. So really, there's like short ends. There's this whole dance you have to do to try and keep it running pretty efficiently. Versus if it was digital, you'd hit record, and every once in a while, you have to swap out a card.
Right.
Yeah.
Got it. Okay. So what was it? I'm sure you've been asked this a lot on this like film tour, but like what was it like for you? Like first of all, you started as a comic, right? Mm-hmm. You are also now an actress, right? Or actor, and now a director in this thing. Like, what was it like for you kind of stepping into that role? Like, did it feel like a big thing, or was it just kind of you doing your thing in a different mode?
I think it was me just doing my thing, me moving out to LA, or even before that, I had been writing my own projects, putting myself in them, editing them, directing them, paying for everything.
Right, that's right. Yeah. You were big on YouTube in the beginning.
Yeah, and that was sort of, you know, I put my projects up on YouTube and people are like, oh, so you YouTube. And not that there's anything wrong with YouTubing, but to me, it was just a platform to post things that I was creating. And so there's always a struggle of, but I want to do other things and I want to make this bigger. And this isn't my end goal.
Do you deal with this? Like, I deal with this definitely. This thing of like trying to communicate to people what it is that you do.
Yeah.
And then wanting to say all of those things.
Yeah.
And then having to realize at some point that like you can't say all of those things.
It doesn't.
What's
it's
the point?
Like, the point is like, okay, you think of me as an actress. That's fine. Or you think of me as a YouTuber. That's totally fine. Literally, it's not worth the fight.
Right.
I do think Emily is sort of struggling with that. Even in the movie, like she's very resistant to anybody. She doesn't know what she does. But anytime somebody thinks they know what she does, she gets very upset about it. I've definitely realized nobody's ever going to know you and what you're capable of. And perhaps people close to you will get a glimpse into all your interests and all the things you can do. The movie is certainly a closer version of all the things that I can do because you see so much of it on display. But it's also, it's just still such a fraction of what I'm thinking about all the time.
Right.
And, you know, now people are going to think I do quirky indie comedies and that's going to be kind of following me around until I do the next thing that is going to change people's perception of it. But yeah, like you said, you can't waste your energy fighting the labels. The scene in the movie that I get asked about so much is her jumping down the guy's throat because he calls her quirky.
Right.
She has a problem with the label. She has a problem throughout the whole movie about being labeled. But there's a level of immaturity thinking that you should waste your energy fighting people labeling you.
Right.
You know what I'm trying to say? So even now I'm sort of dealing with this thing where I'm constantly having to talk about it, but then say, but I don't care. I mean, yes, it bothers me, but I don't want to go on this big campaign or crusade to change the way people talk about me. It would be nice if people talked about me differently, but at the same time, I hope that my body of work eventually will speak for itself.
Yeah, I mean, you're in a business that where marketing is a big component of it, right? And marketing often comes down to explaining something complex in like one sentence.
I mean,
you know?
I guess it's also very American. I mean, yeah. I'm not in marketing when I'm in, you know, school doesn't need to market you, but
right.
I guess it's also just human nature to simplify.
Yeah.
And for me, as a creative, I actually think everything's very complicated. And the more you try and simplify something, the more I am more compelled, I feel, to like go deeper and tear it all apart.
I mean, I don't, you know, not to harp on this, but I think it's all, I just think it's also a phenomenon of just being in, you're in entertainment realms at a time in history when like the noise is so, you know, everything is so crowded and complicated that anyone trying to message anything is just like, what are the three words, you know?
we're in dark times.
These are
super dark times.
Yeah, yeah.
All context is just, it's like as if the meaning of context is completely evaporated. And now everything's literally black or white.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's terrifying. I've always sought to be understood or to understand people. And to understand things, you have to dig deeper.
Right.
And simplifying, I mean, there's beauty in simplicity, and I also recognize that. But
I'm agreeing with you. Like simplicity and oversimplification are two different things.
Right, because like simplicity, something that's elegantly simple, then speaks to the larger context of what it's, you know, the simplicity.
It leaves room for the unknowns or
yes.
whatever. Like
And we're here now where people are just being like, yeah, there's nothing left unknown. It's just the words and the literal thing. And it's not good.
Yeah. So, I mean, so we're talking about like oversimplification and shallowness and so on. So that brings me to what I wanted to also talk about, which is LA and like this thing that, you know, this path that Emily's following and that I guess you followed, right? That takes many different forms, but of like going out there to try to make it. What has that been like for you as somebody who sees things, sees the complexities of life, like just trying to like find your place in that over time?
You know? It's been very frustrating.
correct me if I'm getting your trajectory wrong or anything.
No, like, I went to LA to pursue comedy and but all the while knowing that I would be making bigger and better things through time. And I jumped into a world that was very, you know, everybody my age was just chasing after YouTube and creating viral videos. And that becomes this sort of rat race in and of itself, where kind of a race to the bottom, because if you're attempting to make something viral, you're chasing after lightning in a bottle, but also sort of like appealing to a common denominator that like was quickly spiraling to to lows.
Yeah, there was a dude who like had his girlfriend kill him basically unintentionally. You heard this, right?
Yes, yes.
Holding a Bible that was supposed to block the bullet and like,
It's just, and when I moved to LA, I started making, you know, I just started putting things up because it was just, I was making things but not attempting to make anything go viral. I did have like a video that I made with my friend Molly that is referenced in the movie, where I was lip syncing to Britney Spears' Toxic and pouring food on my head in a shower. And me and her were more excited that there was like an element of we thought the thumbnail was really funny because it was just a girl in the shower. We thought we would trick like 100 dudes into clicking into it, and then we troll them. But it was more just supposed to be our own personal joke about how,
did the stats bear you out? Like when you looked at it later, like could you see it was like mostly men? Like,
I'll tell you.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah.
So within a day, 24 hours after posting it, our video that we thought would just troll 100 people had over 1 million views. So that was the first taste of what going viral was like and what it feels like, and also to having everybody sort of project onto you what you were attempting to do with that. And I had just moved out to LA, and everybody was like, oh, so that's what you're doing with your career? You're trying to make viral videos? And I was like, no, but I didn't take it down because I also thought, to me, it was still very funny. Just the bigger idea of all of it was very funny, how two girls accidentally got a viral video. But we were making comedy, but nobody was seeing it as comedy. So that's kind of referenced in the movie with a video.
They weren't understanding it as comedy?
Most people, the top comment was, I have the weirdest boner. And it was just a comment that happened over and over and over again. And then a lot of people saying there are starving kids in Africa. So we just got two repeating comments.
Okay. And, you're a like selfish, messed up millennial or like sort of weird lust. Like,
yes, I'm appealing to somebody, some perversions that I've tapped into unwittingly. But and even then people didn't, you know, very few people even comedically understood what had happened. And I thought it was funny. It was like this sort of bizarro.
I mean,
art
it's
experiment.
Actually kind of interesting. Yeah, meta prank.
It has like 13 million views now. And people there are people that really enjoy it. There were a lot of people that made versions of the video themselves doing it. So there's something kind of beautiful about that.
So it has, there's fan fiction, basically.
People, there was a guy that had a wig on. A man put on a wig, did his own version of it. I find that very charming and interesting. that it took on this life of its own. But yeah, I moved out to LA and I knew everything that I was doing was like, look, I don't know how to say all the things I want to say yet.
Right.
I have to make things to make that happen. Nobody's going to, you know, weird clubs and doing screenings of weird art videos anymore. Everybody's just putting it on YouTube.
Yeah.
There wasn't really a community to sort of jump into that were doing similar things or talking about the same things that I wanted to do. And so, yeah, I hope I find my people. I feel like I think people are going to be growing up and maybe taking things a little bit more seriously or wanting to get at things that mean a little bit more. Not that everything has to be super serious, but it's just, are you chasing after YouTube money or some quick sell, or do you want to make art or make something that speaks to something?
Yeah, I was kind of talking about this yesterday with Manoush Zomorodi, who runs this podcast Note to Self about technology and has like just written a book about technological addiction and this kind of thing. And we're, you know, it wasn't the first time that this thought had occurred to me that there will be some backlash. I mean, this generation that is now growing up with all this stuff, like looked at from the vantage point of like Gen X, it's kind of like, oh my God, look how shallow this stuff is. But there's got to be some backlash because it's all happened so quickly, you know, and suddenly we're in selfie world and like it can't last forever like that.
Yeah,
you know?
I don't think it will. I think we're
not in
get,
that form, you know.
Like, I don't think we're. I think people are going to grow up.
Yeah.
I think my movie sort of hinted on some version of that, and the next couple projects I want to do is some version of that as well. I've thought a lot about, you know, the confluence of the internet, a crashing economy, and I think the truly psychologically, spiritually, and emotionally traumatizing event that was 9/11 has all of those things have combined to really impact my generation in a way that I don't think people have really studied or even become aware of. And I think we're stagnated. I think we're very fearful. I thought a lot about how come there's so much love for nostalgia and how people my age love things that happened to them when they were kids. And I think it was because it was the last time they truly felt safe or like that there was any sort of future. So this is just kind of getting a little bit more out there.
That's good. Yeah.
But I do believe that we will start recognizing how sick we are, because I do think the internet addiction is an illness. It's this illness that people are making money off of us being ill. There are people that make money off of the fact that we can't get off of our phones, and the fact that there's no sort of morality governing that, or there's no sort of outcry against that, and that everybody wants us to still be on it because it makes people money.
And also, not to turn this into the technology is all evil show, but it also, even worse, seems to then like coerce a generation of creatives into sort of prostituting themselves in a way, like into the same system.
Yeah.
Profiting off of the system that's profiting off of them.
Yeah. And like you say, the technology isn't evil, but there has to be a standard and a morality and a philosophy that we collectively let it govern us by, or we govern it.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's not really been established. And weirdly, I've always felt that it was problematic, and nobody's really been talking about it. And so many people bought into it so quickly. And I benefit from technology. I tweeted, and I tell jokes,
right,
and I share pictures on Instagram, and I uploaded images to Flickr, and I've put things on YouTube, and all these things have definitely benefited me. It's just, it's so all encompassing and it owns so much, and
you just can't
move without you somehow playing into this system. They're public spaces, but they're privatized.
Right.
So I think I'm getting to express myself in a public space, but that's not really what's happening. There are people's agendas we're having to meet. I recently had a thing on Twitter where I got reported for abuse because I made a political statement about misogyny. And
what? Stop. Unpack.
I had been making this pun every time there was gun violence. I truly believe that violence is misogyny. People that defend their right to commit violence are men, right?
Okay.
So that's part of misogyny. When we're saying we don't want guns, like most, liberal people don't want guns, most women don't want guns.
Okay.
Because it's a power dynamic where people are saying it's my right to kill you.
Right.
It's my right to, and that's part
of... So this is a male feeling disempowered, acting out,
right,
kind of against a... something, some system or that he feels is trying to
take away, disempower him.
Yeah. Okay.
And overwhelmingly, and this is, we can all make these, there's obviously women can be violent as well, but overwhelmingly,
violence
is a perpetrator.
We have yet to have a female school shooter.
I mean, when we say that, and of course somebody might do it, and it'll like...
Let's hope they don't do it because of this podcast.
Yeah, please, ladies, let's just talk.
There's another way, yeah, call
in. We can de-escalate.
Yeah.
I've been saying, like, men, and then I made a pun, and I've been making the pun, which is, we have to have gun control, cut off their arms.
Okay.
Right? So here's the pun. It's firearms, whatever. I made this tweet, and then my account got suspended because it was saying that I was being abusive to a group of people, So the irony of all this is, first of all, I was making a pun. My pun was intentionally ironic by me calling out violence, but then me using sort of a faux violent reversal of it.
Because cut
off their arms is a violent image, obviously, if you take it out of context.
Yeah, subtlety doesn't always play
this
on
is what I'm talk-
social media.
This is what I'm talking about. So then I appealed my suspension multiple times and just kept getting denied it, right?
Wow.
So on the flip side of that, when I report when people are harassing me, literally saying horrible things, I've had somebody, I don't want to even bring attention to it, but I've been having this person who makes fake accounts and attacks me all the time, is sharing these things that just aren't true about me that are really terrifying to see somebody doing this, and there's nothing I can do because this person's anonymous, but report them.
Right.
When I report them, they say that there's nothing I can do about it. They say that they're not taking it down. And so it's just this very weird...
We're in an ecosystem where the power, you don't have the shadowy entities in some office building are making decisions.
Exactly. Yeah. I kind of feel like we went off on a little bit of a tangent.
That's okay.
Stuff,
tangents are allowed in this show. Yeah.
I guess the overall, it's just we have to extricate ourselves in a way, or stand up together and get out of this until we develop a philosophy that governs it and we can all recognize what's happening.
So without asking you to sort of solve the internet,
I will try. I could try.
I don't doubt it. But like, what are you, Noelle, like currently thinking of in terms of, you know, you talked about, you know, within what you can disclose or whatever, but like, you know, where you'd like to head in terms of
things I create.
Yeah, things you make that counteract this kind of
you
stuff.
You know, it's...
If that's not... Is that too much to
No,
ask?
I mean, okay. I have multiple movie ideas in my head, things I would like to write. Sometimes it feels very selfish to be like, well, I'm going to write a movie and like get to act. But I do think...
That's what you do. That's how you're a communicator. That's
I like
what
to
you do.
Yeah. But outside of that, I think... my next movie will be dealing with all of this sort of directly, and who knows if it'll be a successful movie, but I do think it'll hopefully get to share my thoughts about where we are. And outside of that, I really believe in helping people curtail the toxicity on the internet. And to do that, it's, there's like a level of like teaching people how to think, if that makes sense.
Yeah, sure. Or critical thinking, awareness of the world they're living in.
Right.
And
I saw Bill Nye give a talk, and he had a good point where he was like, we've taught kids critical thinking skills. We need to teach them critical filtering skills, where you can look at something instead of, you know, you have to become like the Russian troll situation. It's like they're messing with us, and you have to be one step ahead of them. I had a situation, so going back to this tweet, I posted on my Instagram when my account got suspended, basically being like, look, our president gets to fight with world leaders, basically harass women, be racist, and yet he's getting to still tweet. I make a pun, I get my account suspended. And then somebody started commenting on my account being like, or you're being rightly punished for your misandry and racism, because I had said something about white men, because I know those are the people that reported my thing. Okay. And so, but here's where I was like, here's where this is the crazy thing. They were commenting from an account with an image of a beautiful African American woman. So I was like, my first instinct was like, oh my God, like how could she misunderstand me this way, right? So that was my first instinct. And then I was like, wait a second. Let me click on this link. Of course, this person has zero followers, is a troll. It is literally a troll who has understood that you can divide liberals and pit them against each other or start fights with people by using images of a woman who basically suffers the most at the hand of like white misogyny.
If it's not yet possible to write an algorithm that does that, it soon will be anyway.
Right.
But yeah.
Yeah. Like, so they just, like, and so I reported the account. Yeah, it got taken down. Mm. They created another account immediately. Mm. And it was such an interesting thing. I was like, you know, I have followers, but I don't have that many followers. How did they find my account? Like, how did this happen? Why did I get targeted?
Keywords. Yeah, they like they must have.
And so instead of like fighting with this person, I was like, I see what's happening. People need to see that this is happening. One of the solutions I think is we need to remove all comments section. There's no way to really quite get people, because the sickness is people fighting with each other and thinking you can get anywhere by fighting with somebody that's in another state that's like doesn't understand your point of view.
But I mean, removing commenting from social media basically makes it not social media anymore.
Maybe we go out and we start talking to each other more.
I'm fine with that. I'm cool with that. We could do that. Yeah.
But I'm sure that'll present a whole other layer of problems.
No, but I find it refreshing to hear you talking this way. And so I'm totally on board with this movement.
Cool.
That's pretty cool.
I think we'll figure it out though. Hopefully. I do think the point of being alive is hopefully to eke out some level of happiness. And I think we can all agree the internet is making everybody very unhappy.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. And there are a lot of smart and tough and, you know, independent minded people in the world who can counteract this stuff if they want to.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Is cool. that exhausting?
No, that was wonderful. That's not exhausting at all. But I think that is a perfect place. And this I'm saying for the audience, let's move into the second part of the show, which is where we are going to look at some surprise videos that could be on any topic and just talk about them. Sound good?
Yep.
Okay, cool. Oh, this will be fun. Okay, so this one is Reza Aslan, who is a commentator, academic, and writer. Mostly about religion and theology. And this one is called, What is Religion For? Morality, Power, Evolution.
Over the last couple of hundred years, there's been an enormous amount of thought that's gone into the question of why religion. You know, the one thing that we all agree on is that religion has been a part of the human experience from the beginning. In fact, we can trace the origin of religious experience to before Homo sapiens. We can trace it with some measure of confidence to Neanderthals. We can measure it with a little less confidence all the way to Homo erectus. So we're talking hundreds of thousands of years before our species even existed. So the question is why? You know, if religion is a universal phenomenon, or rather I should say religious experience, if religious experience is a universal phenomenon, if it can be traced in all peoples, all cultures, and throughout all time, then there must be some evolutionary reason for it. There must be a reason, some adaptive advantage to having religious experience or faith experience, otherwise it wouldn't exist. And so there have been, over the last couple of centuries, numerous attempts to figure out exactly what that adaptive advantage would be. The most popular explanation, of course, is the sociological one, that religion creates a sense of cohesion amongst a group. And that sense of cohesion, the idea that we could come together and create a collective identity based on shared symbols or shared metaphors, gave an adaptive advantage to believing communities that non-believing communities did not have. That's a pretty good answer. The problem is that religion is as much a divisive issue as it is a cohesive one. It's as good at creating out-groups as it is in-groups. And more importantly, the problem with that, the social cohesion theory, is that kinship was a much more powerful and much more dominant form of social cohesion than religion was. Our ancestors lived in small communities that were bound together by blood, by relationship, by kinship, long before they created symbols and mythologies in order to unify them.
We can go any way with this. I mean, where do you want to go?
Well, I will just say my gut reaction is that I don't necessarily think that a religion arose as an evolutionary sort of advantage. I think it is just an attempt to codify human experience in the same way that art or language attempts to describe things that are happening. And I think it's a consciousness experience, and it necessarily brings people together because it's bringing, when religion works or when a spiritual experience is sort of taking hold of a group of people, it actually does meld and bond people.
Right.
And those experiences, I think, are so powerful, and then people have such a strong sense of what really reality is all about, that the reason why then religion becomes so divisive is because then people that don't have those experiences sort of want the power or the the benefit of what they're seeing, those spiritual experiences happening.
So people outside of the community feel threatened by
that cohesion. Or they want to capture it or want to have the power that that experience actually has.
I would also point out, you know, that like it happens within the communities as well. Like somehow, you know, what this made me think of in terms of this idea we were talking about, that society has lost direction overall, mm-hmm. right? And that, you know, people in the past and still in many places look to religion for that sense of meaning and that sense of cohesion. But like, not only does it create sometimes alienation between groups, but also within the group, as soon as you have this kind of like shared structure of meaning, it often seems to set up internal hierarchies, right? Like,
yeah.
who is the keeper of the secret? You know,
yeah.
who is the closest to it? You know?
Yeah, and that, I think, and that is just human ego.
Yeah,
and
yeah, yeah.
I think that can apply to everything. Like, well, right. I know more than you.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I think a lot about those, like, sort of utopian communities that people have tried to create at different times in history. Like,
yeah.
in the 1890s, they were doing a bunch of them in upstate New York. And then we know about, you know, the late 60s and sort of hippie communes and whatever.
Yeah.
And how they all seem
sort of
to kind of fall apart. Yeah, like,
yeah, because somebody...
sleeps with everyone.
It's
what
always about
happens.
Sex.
Yeah,
yeah, yeah, it's yeah. always. It's actually just. Gosh, I really do think so much of the problems in the world are just like weird power structures
yeah.
and people wanting power over other people.
Mm.
That is just the fault of human nature. Is mm. you know want. It's such a weird thing. And
I think so. And going back yeah. to what you were saying before. Like, if women were in charge of everything, would it be better?
Okay, so I have a lot of opinions about this as well.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, we've spent so much time trying to prove that women are equals to men, that men or that women can do anything that a man can do and that they should be valued, right?
Right.
And then there's this idea that, well, women should be in charge. I actually think the balance is that men and women coexist and actually just respect each other's talents. And
right.
I believe that intuition is a very real thing that women have a lot of access to. That is a kind of a weird thing that men, it's hard for men to understand. And that's a lot of why we've been sort of enslaved and put underneath men, because it is like a sort of power. But if men started respecting that, and that our capacity to do that and start valuing women, then the need to like be on top wouldn't necessarily
right.
need to exist amongst men or women, that we would find ways to cohabitate. And so it really is this power, any power dynamic is really the heart of like all of our problems, is when anybody wants to be like, well, women should be on charge. It's like, no, that's just going to make, because there are women that don't understand how things should be run, and to then use
right.
just your existence as one sort of group as a way to put down another group is just definitely not the answer.
I mean, I can imagine someone in the audience, so I should put this like footnote, which is that like maybe we're talking about like gender energies, you know,
yeah.
more than we necessarily are talking strictly about men and women, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yes,
masculinity,
yes, yes.
femininity,
and
those energies.
Like, so we're talking about exactly.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
all of, yes, a man can have both energies
right.
and a woman. I think what it is just heightening our awareness, and it's kind of, you know, religions, sort of are about recognizing the inherent energies that are in the universe that sort of...
Right.
I think our real battle is battling literalness. And it's complicated because I'm a big fan of like math and science and very liberal or literal sort of minded things.
Fact-based things.
Fact-based.
Yeah.
I love facts. Facts
right,
are great.
Right.
But without context and without a holistic perspective on them... those things can also be perverted and twisted.
Right.
And we see now there's fake news. Like there's just ways that, you know what I mean?
Yeah,
where
yeah.
we have facts and then that, but now there's not this like sort of holistic point of view. I have a lot of thoughts. About,
yeah, yeah, yeah.
But
no,
when,
yeah, actually amazingly you've hit on not necessarily having read Reza Aslan's book, you've hit on like kind of the central thing he was saying when I was talking to him, which was about, he was basically trying to say that a lot of the problems that arise within religion are a result of people taking things that ought to be symbolic, ought to be metaphorical, you know, ought to be understood in an intuitive, personal way, literally.
Yep.
And that plays out, yeah, everywhere.
And
right?
that plays out
yeah.
in art and cinema and
right.
communication. It's this psychological game of... also humans needing to be right and
mm-hmm.
defend their point of view.
Right.
Because if your point of view is somehow wrong, and I'm doing that in quotes.
Right.
It feels like to the human psyche that you're going to be obliterated.
Right.
And we're the only thing we're afraid of is dying, whether that's literal death or some kind of
being
mental
made spiritual. Irrelevant in yeah. the conversation or whatever. Yeah.
So this is also another place that I think our culture needs to move to. I really don't like the punitive nature that we've, you know, this like, you're right and I'm wrong.
And the sort of culture of outrage and totally destroy. Although I have to say, like, that becomes problematic, and that's a whole nother rabbit hole that maybe we don't want to go down. But like, when it comes to this, like, Bill Cosby, Charlie Rose, yeah. you know, that's a whole nother,
well,
you know.
It's like, yeah, well, we can definitely say that that's wrong. But, yeah. oh my so, gosh, anyway, we're so messed up right now. Do you know what I mean? I gave this other interview where I was like, listen, I'm so happy that this is coming out, because most of my life I've lived in an existence where I don't understand why I feel so bad and why bad things are happening to me and why I can't be taken seriously and why I'm doing all the same things as men in my life. And yet I'm the one that keeps getting let go from jobs just for sticking up for myself. And then having these things finally come to the surface, it's like, oh, now people can finally hear me and understand what I'm talking about. And it just raises everybody's consciousness level. On the flip side of it, it's going to become tumultuous, because now people are going to see this as an opportunity to punish people when you know what I mean?
There will be
witch
hunts as well. Yeah. Yes. And it I was thinking the other day that there would be a very funny comedy routine, like, if, you know, like a guy trying to date a woman and just being like, well, you know, if you might be interested
right,
in
exactly.
possibly,
yes.
I don't know your availability, and I certainly don't want to presume in any way, you know, like, it
yes.
can complicate things,
it's
I suppose.
It's going to be complicated, but you know what? Thank God for a little bit for them.
Yeah,
not
I'm
to be
I'm certainly
to,
not pushing
no,
back
no, no.
against these guys being outed. Like,
but it's
please,
definitely
yeah.
going to be, but I think what needs to be in question is just this entitlement that men have, that they literally run the world, that they can get what they want to serve themselves, and not even understanding inherently that women have any worth outside of how they augment a male's experience.
Right.
And I think that that's what we're pushing back against.
And that we're allowed to, like, somehow live in a dual reality where it's like, everyone knows that this stuff is not okay, but on another level within these communities, especially like power structures like Hollywood or whatever, it's just kind of like, that's the way it goes.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
Like,
it's like, yeah, he yells and he screams and he also sort of rapes people, like, but you know,
that's,
the paycheck's really nice.
That's the deal. That's how it's always been, you know? Yeah. But like, and somehow we're supposed to occupy that totally schizophrenic dual reality.
Right.
Like,
women that want to take a stand against that, then they're ejected from
blackballed. Yeah, blacklisted,
literally,
whatever.
And it's just,
yeah.
So then this comes, that's also a version of literalness, though, that I think we're, you know, and why I think the punitive culture is problematic, because it's like, well, on the one hand, people need to evolve their understanding of existence. It's
right.
like, if I can convey to you as a male that might not have understood what I was going through, and then suddenly you have a sense of what it's like to be me and why I haven't been heard, and like maybe seeing how you might have contributed to that, and then if you then now understand it, thank God, let's now go make things together.
Right.
I don't need to abuse you and
right,
now be
right.
on top.
It shouldn't
and, like,
always be a zero sum game, like either
yeah.
I, you know, right, everyone, right.
Yeah.
My enemies are strewn in the streets. Like,
yeah, that's definitely, so then,
yeah,
you
like,
know, religion, I think most religions are all about unity and bringing people together. And it's just a very hypocritical sort of thing when people then are more punitive. It's such a strange, it's a consciousness thing too. I think there's certain people's consciousness exist at like, I'm right, you're wrong.
Right.
Instead of being like, oh, maybe we're all kind of wrong and we're also all kind of right.
I mean, the thing is, like, I think following on from what you're saying, like we need to jostle against one another so that we can actually like express the things that we need to, you know, like, I mean, that these conversations can happen and any kind of progress
right.
can happen, right?
Right?
Maybe it wouldn't happen. I don't know if there was this kind of more kind of utopian collective kind of, you know, consciousness that you're sort of pointing at. But like, but I guess what I'm thinking is that what we need is to not kill each other, but we need to struggle sometimes. You know?
Yeah, like, we need to be able to. here's something that I've realized. Like, we do need to be able to fight with each other.
Yeah.
But we need to be able to fight with each other where it's like safe fighting.
Right, right.
Where, you know, we're not going to
ruin each
other's
lives. We
recognize
the other person's humanity. We're not trying to destroy one another.
Like, so yeah, I've been getting mad at my guy friends lately, and I've been really standing up at them and chewing them out and being like, dude, enough. You just need to take some responsibility. And now it's like, they're like, oh, I'm so afraid now. Like, I can't say anything. It's like, no, you can talk, but maybe for once you should just listen and understand that there is something you are not getting. And if you can just open yourself up to the possibility that you are not, you don't understand everything already, then we can move on and like start having fun again. But like, I'm just mad at you because I'm just trying to communicate and you're refusing to hear me. I've spent my whole life understanding you.
Right.
Like women bend over backwards to try to be a part of a man's world, try and adopt the point of view. And it's not working for us because it's just not working. So could you understand what I'm trying to get at?
Yeah. And well, and if they want to push back and they actually have something to say while listening to what you're saying, then fine, you know, but like, you know, but if they don't, then that thing of like, I don't feel safe anymore. Like that's a dodge. That's they're not sitting with what you're giving them. You
Know? Like, well, and then it's also, it's like maybe because that's their ego thing. They don't want to admit that maybe they're wrong. And I was like, well, guess what? As a woman, I have had 30 years of experience of I'm wrong all the time, even if I'm not wrong. I mean, I'm just, I'm constantly apologizing for things and I feel so ill and I'm so sick all the time and I'm wondering why. It's because I'm literally living in backwards world.
Yeah.
So it's exciting that this is all coming out. I think it only, now we've definitely gone on a tangent. Religion.
It's good.
Evolutionarily, I think it has evolved our consciousness. When people have mystical religious sort of experiences, it actually elevates our consciousness within, allows us to have these sorts of higher-ended conversation.
Yeah, if anything, it enables us maybe to transcend some of the stupid kind of fact-based realities that we get kind of stuck in, you know, where it's like, this has happened to me and that happened to, and this is the story of our little life.
We need to go fight, pick up a gun, kill somebody if you have like a religious
or
mystical.
Because you're locked into a narrative or whatever.
If you have like a mystical experience, you could be like, wait a second. Oh, I see. This is all, we're all in this together.
Wait a minute, bro. I could turn this gun into a bong.
Whoa.
Dude, that's
tight.
So I think we have 10 minutes left and we could do one more.
Real quick.
So this is David Eagleman, the neuroscientist, talking about creativity. The video is called Understanding Creativity, Why Brain Hacks Don't Help.
There are many books that exist on creativity, and it's about, hey, do this, take a hot shower, take a long walk in nature, be in a pink room or something. What my co-author, Anthony Brandt, and I really strove to do here was to figure out what is below all of that. What is the basic cognitive software that's running in the human brain that takes ideas in and smooshes them up and crunches them, and it's like a food processor that's constantly spitting out new ideas. What is it that's special about the human brain that allows creativity to happen? Because when you look at us compared to all the other species on the Earth, we have very similar brains. I mean, you know, obviously we're cousins with our nearest neighbors and all throughout the animal kingdom. It's a continuous family tree. But there's this one species that has gone, that does these incredible, we're in New York City right now. And when I flew in here, it's like looking at a motherboard that has risen from the earth. And when you fly over a forest, it looks the same as it did a million years ago. So we're running around the planet doing something unbelievable. You don't have squirrels going to the moon or dogs inventing the internet or cows doing theater plays for one another or any of the gajillion things that we do. We're doing something really different, and that's what Anthony and I have really tried to understand. What's special about the human brain is that we during the evolution of the cortex, got a lot more space in between input and output. So other animals have these much closer together, so when they get some stimulus, they make a essentially reflexive response. In humans, as the cortex expanded, there's a lot more room there, which means that inputs can come in and sort of percolate around and get stored and get thought about, and then maybe you make an output or maybe you don't. And there's one other thing that happened with the expansion of the cortex, which is that we got a much bigger prefrontal cortex. That's the part right behind the forehead. And that is what allows us to simulate what-ifs, to separate ourselves from our location in space and time, and think about possibilities.
I love reading about the brain, and I've attempted to unstick myself for years, and I've done a lot of different modalities and have read a lot of different theories about...
You meditate?
I meditate. Yeah. Actually, I got into the brain, reading about the brain, because I randomly did a 21-day meditation challenge like 5 years ago.
21 days meditating every day. I was thinking you went on a retreat for 21 days.
No. It was just a 7-minute meditation. Okay. And I did 21 days in a row with a friend who just was like, and I thought it was going to be the hokiest thing in the world. And at the time I had really horrible stomach problems that were basically debilitating, and I had gone on all these diets trying to fix them. Within 21 days, my stomach stopped hurting. Huh? And not only that, I didn't even realize I had, essentially my brain was just a cacophony of me beating myself up and saying the same things over and over again.
Yep.
I would say something out loud and it would just bounce around in my head for days. I was so embarrassed. Within 21 days, that kind of had stopped. And so I kept meditating and I don't hear thoughts in my brain anymore. Like, I don't hear words. Hmm. I have impulses and I think, but they're not like, I'm not nervous.
That chatter is not happening.
The chatter's not there. So I think we really are of multiple minds.
Yeah.
So there's different layers in our brain. They all serve different functions. And what meditation does, or what things like taking a shower or doing a walk, what they're doing is they're just synchronizing our brain to work together. Mm-hmm. The two lobes, and not only that, like, it actually quiets our prefrontal cortex, which is in charge of like making us chatter. And it's right. Like what makes people very literal. It's a literal part
that
of our brain.
That stuff is like noise in the system, you know?
Yeah.
It's like that's interfering with this slack that we're supposed to have.
Yeah, so yeah. We're supposed to have this slack and this openness and this spaciousness for ideas to arise out of. And, you know, there's also a part of us creatively. So meditation helped me with the prefrontal cortex, the noise. Then I had to go to therapy to deal with the other part, which is right here, the limbic part of your brain or whatever it's called, the reptilian part of
just
your brain.
Just fear and
yeah, which is what most animals have.
Yeah,
so it's the subconscious. It's what drives all of our fears and all of the things that basically get in our way. And that's much harder to communicate with because it doesn't speak in words. Mm. And oftentimes we don't even know what's happening. We just know that we're anxious or, you know, it's...
Right. So these are, rather than thoughts, you know, you're not good enough, et cetera, these are feelings that flood the system.
And there, a lot of them are body, it's actually your body communicates to that part of your brain. So your body has defense mechanisms that kind of get caught, that if you don't let your brain process them, they just live and they're just happening over and over and over again.
It's like fight or flight. You're triggering fight or flight responses.
Yeah. And and the things that you react to are stored in your brain. And so like familiar situations then trigger them. And if you don't let them play out, or if you like, you know, our brains, we stop things from playing out. We don't let emotions evolve because we've been taught that having emotions bad, but that part of your brain, every time you stop it, it doesn't allow the sort of natural emotional response, which is actually very short, to evolve.
All of these things are interruptions of flow in the system, basically.
Yeah.
So they're blockages that we're partly doing cognitively or whatever, but they're blocking flow.
Like, yeah. So they're blocking the natural... It's basically our brains are not working together, all of our brains. So
not integrated or whatever.
Yeah. So when you do things like a meditation or you take a shower or you take a walk or you do something you really love, like you start painting, what's happening is you're actually... First of all, your prefrontal cortex gets to shut up because you're not paying attention to it. Because all of this is also about attention. So your prefrontal cortex shuts up. The limbic part of your brain, the emotions get to play out. The ones that you're feeling are caught in a loop. They evolve naturally. Right. And when they evolve naturally, they stop being triggered. And then all of a sudden, you're being able to be creative again. because you're just in sort of an empty space. And yeah, that's my experience, and based on things that have worked for me and all the things that I've read.
That's cool. No, you've gone deep into this.
Yeah, and it goes from both ends. Here's the other thing. It's like we can be very literal about it. We can look at it from a neuroscientific point of view.
Right.
But if we're one of my big things as a very emotional person and living in a world where people don't respect emotions or think that they're valid or real, I've had to go very deep into processing emotions and recognizing that it's all sort of together. And you can't really understand the brain if you're not actually understanding the emotional responses that are being triggered by your body.
I sometimes think that is our problem, you know, and what I think relates to what you're calling literalness, which is the explanatory tendency. Like when we try to, we get caught up because we can't come up with a perfect explanation for things, right?
Yeah.
So we're looking for the right words, and a lot of these fights happen because certain things can't be expressed.
It can't be conveyed.
Words,
yeah, you know? You can't. Religion can't be conveyed in words. Yeah, that's why we do the symbols, and that's when people take them literally. Yeah, I think, so I love being literal. It's part, you know, it's very helpful when I'm making decisions and organizing things.
How to organize a film shoot.
Exactly. Yeah. Like, that's where that comes in handy. But when I'm trying to talk about a bigger human experience, it's like I can't really use that part of my brain. And then that's why half my movie is me just like not talking or just trying to be like, here, let me just do a goofy dance because this is what I'm trying to talk about.
Yeah, I think that's as good a place as any to leave it. Noelle Wells, I've really enjoyed having you on the show. Thanks so much for coming.
Thank you. That was so fun.
It was totally fun. And Mr. Roosevelt, your film, it's in theaters right now. There's not so much neuroscience in it, but it is delightful and smart and funny. And everyone should go see it.
Thank you. And it'll come out on Netflix December 26th.
Awesome. Thanks so much for listening to another twisty, turny conversation here on Think Again. Public service announcement, we are back next week, and then we're going to go dark or silent, however you say it in podcasting, for 3 full weeks, returning on January 13th, 2018, with a whole new outlook. Well, same basic outlook, but we're going to be back on January 13th. If you want to keep the conversation going in the meantime, please feel free to join our Facebook group, Friends of Think Again, a Big Think podcast. Lots of you have already joined, and things over there are always very smart and lively. Next week, I'm back for one last episode before our break with German-Turkish filmmaker Fatih Akın. See you then.
Our bodies come in different shapes and sizes, so doesn't it make sense that our weight loss plans should too? That's the beauty of Noom. They build a personal plan that factors in dietary restrictions, medical issues, and other personal needs so your plan works for you. Noom doesn't restrict or shame when you want to treat yourself. Their flexible program focuses on progress instead of perfection. You don't have to give up carbs or anything. And with their daily lessons, you can learn something new about your food choices every day. After just a few days of using the app, I learned how to recognize cues for overeating and how to choose the right foods to feel full. Stay focused on what's important to you with Noom's psychology and biology-based approach. Sign up for your trial today at Noom.com. That's Noom.com. And check out Noom's first ever cookbook, The Noom Kitchen, for 100 healthy and delicious recipes to promote better living. Available to buy now wherever books are sold.